to be here at that 8. Please welcome Russell.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a privilege to be here with you guys. It's always good for me to be at an AA meeting, and it's a privilege whenever you're asked to share your experience and the grace of God, and which has kept me sober and helped me out. And I only hope I can express some way, at least I'll do the best job I can tonight. Might be the worst AA meeting I ever do, but it's going to be the best one I could do tonight to try to explain a little bit to you about how these things are working in my life. I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 17th, 1981, so which isn't a record around here, it's a record for me, but I came in here when I was 31 years old. I'm going to be 62 in March, and I've got four. I've been married for 30 years. I think I've shared this before. I got married a couple of months after I got sober. My sponsor said, "Don't make any major decisions." I didn't think it was a big deal, but I. So I'm not one to talk about relationships, you know. And not gonna, because I immediately got married, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I laughingly, sort of semi-jokingly, say, you know, that I love my wife and I have a great marriage. It was a little rough for the first 29 years, but it seems to be getting okay now. You know, she's starting to calm down. She's a member of Al-Anon, our ladies of perpetual revenge. She does an Al-Anon 10-step. When I'm wrong, she promptly admits it. You know, she's very. And I have four children that I've raised, and son and three daughters, and six grandchildren. And I know what it's like to be bored in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know what it's like to be scared. I know what it's like to have your house foreclosed on. I know what it's like to be broke. I know what it's like to have money. I know what it's like not. I know what it's like to have cancer. I know what it's like to be sick. I know what it's like to lose people and suffer in Alcoholics Anonymous over a long period of time. I know what it's like to have a lot of people and resentments and all sorts of crap going on in your brain. I know what it's like to have a tough time in Alcoholics Anonymous over a long period of time, and I know what it's like to be exhilarated. So I know what it's like to experience life. I think that's the greatest thing that happens if you stay sober in here. No matter how you do this thing, good, bad, or indifferent, you're going to, if you stay sober, you're going to get to experience the deal. You're going to get to experience this thing sober. So I want to share a few things with you. One of my favorite things to share, and I've done it, I think, in 4, 5, maybe even 6, is share a lot about fear, which is the corrosive thread, which is a big deal for alcoholics. I'm going to share a little bit about that now when we're talking about 8 and 9 relationships. But I'll probably maybe focus a little bit more on one of my favorite topics, guilt, which is closely aligned with fear. I think it pretty much is sort of like a form of fear. It says our basic problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. You know, through 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, we step on the toes of others and they retaliate. That's the real problem. It says we must get rid of the selfishness or else it'll kill us. God makes that possible. And it says 100 fear has 100 forms, and I think one of the forms of fear is guilt. So I want to share a little bit about that, because guilt is, as horrible as fear is, I just think guilt is just another aspect of it. It's a horrible thing to live life guilty. Feeling guilty. And you know what the real horrible thing about being an alcoholic? You know, it says in the book somewhere, the part where it says alcoholics are men and women who like the experience, you know, what, like the effect produced by alcohol. They are restless, irritable, discontented, unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And it says to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. You see, that's interesting. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. In other words, no matter how bad it is, no matter how ravenous and horrible our minds are, no matter how horrible we feel, no matter how bad it gets, at any particular time, we think we're normal. You know, we may be depressed, but we think that's sort of like normal. I mean, the way we think, as unhealthy as it is, as unhealthy as our relationships may be. You know, everybody on the outside could say, look at what's going on with you. But to us, it's like normal because we can't see that there's possibly a different way of doing things. You know, for many years, I didn't think one of the first things the guy who became my first sponsor told me, he says, you don't have to drink anymore if you don't want to. He said two things to me. He says, Rush, you never have to drink again if you don't want to, and you never have to feel the way you feel if you don't want to. And at 31 years old, and I was a pretty bright guy, you could have asked me, I would have told you that. At 31 years old, I thought I had to drink. I couldn't envision not feeling the way I felt. You know, I didn't know how to not feel. You know, you ever people say, why can't you be like your brother? Why can't you? I mean, how do you do that deal? I only know how to be me. And so, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and of course, like most alcoholics, I thought I was brilliant, and I was brilliant, by the way, and like all alcoholics are. I went to one AA meeting. It's the only one I've ever heard this at. I went to one AA meeting where a guy chaired the meeting, and he had about 6 or 7 years, and I had a few months, and I could swear that what the meeting was about was, he said, it was about how the average alcoholic is smarter than regular people. In other words, if you go into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and pick out 10 people, and then you go to the outside and just at random pick out 10 people, the IQ of the alcoholics, don't start smiling like you believe this shit, you know what I mean? I mean, it's a crap. I'm looking out there and I see that there are people that are like buying into this crap. This is just a story. It's a true story, but don't think for one second it has any resemblance to the truth. You understand what I'm saying? Just because it makes you feel good, you know, doesn't mean it's true. But anyway, this is what this guy said. He said that the average alcoholic is, the IQ is higher than the average. And I said, well, that sounds pretty right to me, you know. I immediately liked this guy, and I knew he was very intelligent, and so I kept on looking. I kept on looking for that information because I figure, you know, if he knew it, it must be pretty common knowledge. So I kept on waiting for this information to, like, come out. You know, like maybe I'd see it on TV or Newsweek maybe on Time Magazine, you know, the picture of a guy sort of silhouetted out and saying those incredibly brilliant alcoholics, you know, but apparently that may not be true. He's probably the only guy who I've heard. That's the only meeting I've ever heard that at. And if we are intelligent, we have a funny way of showing it. Smashing our cars in the walls and going through 15 divorces and ending in jail and going broke, you know, in order to do that deal. But, you know, what happened was I came to Alcoholics Anonymous pretty much because I couldn't stop drinking. I looked some guy in the eye and said, I need help. I can't stop drinking. I had probably said before, I need help, I need money, or I need a girl, or I need a car, or I need... But I had finally reached the point, somehow, some way, where I realized that my life was unmanageable, even though I didn't say those exact... I realized that my life was unmanageable, and I was able to connect, somehow, at the worst part of my life. I mean, my mind wasn't even working that well. I had, like, two neurons working, they were waving goodbye at each other. I was able to realize that somehow my life was unmanageable, and the unmanageability of my life was somehow connected to the fact that I couldn't stop drinking. And I said that, because I said, I need help, I can't stop drinking. And unfortunately, I was, you know, I came in here in a weakened state. And, you know, I used to be, a yes brother and an if onlyer, you know. If only I had money, I'd be okay, you know. It was like this, as soon as I get the girl, I'll be, as soon as I get the money, as soon as I win the lottery, as soon as I get that job. I mean, my life was on the verge of actually happening. You know, I mean, I was just this far away of being fantastic, you know. But there was always a missing ingredient. If I was only in Milwaukee, you know, if I only, you know, if I was only elected, if I was only, and you know, alcoholics, the interesting thing about alcoholics is they're sort of, well, you know, obviously not you guys. You guys, I can tell, are like a cut above the average alcoholic. But the guys I hang around in the Carl Gables group, you know, alcoholics tend to be confused. Did you ever notice that? You know, like they say, they sit around, you sit in a classroom and say, I know the answer. I know the answer to that question, but you're scared to raise your hand because what if you're wrong? You say, why don't they elect me president, but you're scared to run? You know what I mean? They ought to listen to me, you know. Why don't they listen to me, but you don't want to go to the podium because you're not ready? You know, it's always that you want something so badly, and you know you should get it, but you just don't want to do the action. That's what happens in here many times in Alcoholics Anonymous. People say they want to stay sober and they want this thing. They want what you have. But for some, so you say, how do I do it? You say, show up here. They say, I can't do that. So we're the kind of guys that we want to be at a certain place, but we just don't want to do the deal that's necessary to get to that place. And I was beaten down, and unfortunately, I ended up in the hands of a brutal and mean and abusive alcoholic sponsor. I was brilliant. I told him I was brilliant, and I had degrees. I had all sorts of postgraduate degrees on the wall that said I was brilliant, and unfortunately, God saw fit to put me in the hands of a used car salesman that didn't even graduate grade school, you know, and he had about 20 years sobriety. His name was Bob Sullivan, and he would say mean things to me, like, and I think I've shared this with you before. One time he said to me, I told him about all the degrees. I took him to my office. I showed him all the degrees. He says, "Well, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those." I mean, I don't even know how you combat stuff like that. I mean, when I went to college and I was, you know, a division chief in the state attorney's office trying murder cases, and nobody ever said to me, you know, rectal thermometers or anything. I remember one time he said to me, he said, "Russ, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father." I had to think about that for about a half an hour because I wasn't sure what that meant. I thought he might be complimenting me, you know. And then he'd get together with his old-timer cronies and they'd laugh at me, and I was the subject of derision. So I, you know, that kind of thing. So I didn't even have a chance to be a smart ass. I tried, but I didn't. And then I went from him. He ultimately passed away and sober. And then I had a wonderful sponsor named Joe Snyder. And I like to bring these things up because I want you to understand that I absolutely believe. I don't know. This thing is still a mystery to me. There's a few things I sort of know and understand. After 30 years of doing this, after sponsoring many men, after watching people go in and out and doing this myself in my own life, most of the stuff is a mystery, but there's certain things I can see. There's certain patterns I know based upon my experience. There's certain things I understand that are true for me. They may not be true for you, that are true for me. And I can't tell you, you know, I can't tell you, well, this was more important than that, or reading the book was all I can tell you. And I can't even tell you I did this perfectly. But what I can tell you is I believe and I know that wherever I am today and whatever I have today, and I'm grateful for whatever I had something to do with the people I chose to hang out with. Well, it's like the opposite of that thing. You lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. You know, it's like I heard once at a non-AA event, you know, a sports figures say, you know, the man you'll be 5 years from now will depend upon the people you hang out with, the books you read. And I found that the books I read are dependent upon who I hang out with. And I just, for some reason, I chose to hang out with these men. And they had 15, 20 years, and they weren't around here looking to get laid. They weren't. They really weren't. They weren't allowed here, around here, you know, cuddling up with their girlfriend, with their arms around them, necking in the back of the room. They weren't in the parking lot smoking or joking. They were about as serious as a heart attack, okay? And that's the people I chose to hang around, and I'm just glad I did. And I don't know why. I don't even take credit for that. I don't even say I was smart enough to do that, because I wasn't smart enough to do that. You know, you know what I think it was? It was exactly what they, the longer I'm sober, the longer I realize I can align what happened to me with what they talk, their experience in the big book. What it says in the big book is it says, if you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And all I can tell you is, those men I spotted, and I wanted what they had, and I was willing to do anything to get what they had, and I didn't even know what they had. It was just one of these things that I hung around these guys, and they had something different than anybody else. So it was, you know, I could just tell they were different. There was something different around them. Maybe it was a sense of peace they had around them, or they weren't complainers. You know, I was talking to a guy, sponsor a bunch of guys, and I love. It's a privilege to sponsor people, and you know, some guys I sponsor have like 18, 20, 25 years, you know, that kind of thing. And I was driving down here with one of the guys who's here tonight sponsoring, and anybody who knows me, who I sponsor, knows I do this thing with them. I say, so what's going on? You know, we get in the car and say, so what's the deal? What's going on? And so this particular guy said, what do you mean? I said, there you go. You're doing great. You know what I've noticed? I noticed that people who are doing well in this program don't have much to say. I mean, I'm just telling you about some of the, they just don't have. Have you ever noticed that some alcoholics, especially when they're new, have a whole lot to talk about? You ever notice that? Has that ever happened in AA? Like alcoholics that are new in AA? I was like that. have just a lot of stuff to talk about. They got a lot of stuff. It's like there's a never-ending stream of consciousness. There's this, and then there's that, and there's this, and there's that. I can always tell when a guy's doing okay when I say, so what's going on? And he has to, and there's like nothing going on. There's like absolutely, he's like blank, you know? And that's always a good sign when you're blank, you know? And I used to sit around saying, how do you do that? How do you do blank? My world is coming apart, you know? Things are happening. People are on my mind, you know? You know, I forgot about this because it's been a long time since this happened to me. Every once in a while, anybody here, you don't have to raise your hand. Everybody here ever have people, anybody here ever have a situation where you're thinking about somebody? You know, you're just thinking about, that's never happened to anybody? Where you're thinking about somebody? It's horrible, isn't it? You know, I mean, I used to do that all the time. I'd have all sorts of people in my mind. People in my mind, this one and that one, and what's he going to say and what she's going to do, and just the overcrowding mind with people, and it was bad, and I had bad thoughts. You know, I had to have a radio going or a TV going or something going on or be on the phone or be doing something. I couldn't stand silence, because if there was silence, if I wasn't distracted, I was thinking, and I never wanted to think the thoughts I thought, because the thoughts I thought were bad thoughts about myself and other people, and made me uncomfortable. And I didn't know how to get out of that deal. I didn't know how to stop that deal, especially if you ever had that deal at 3 o'clock in the morning with the people and the fears and the, you know, what did I say and why did I say it and what are they thinking, what are they saying, and how do you get rid of that? You can't even say, I'm not going to think about that. It's just sort of like you're powerless over that deal. Sure, Anthony, you're laughing. You don't know what it's like. It's a bad deal. So even I want to read a couple of things, but this is the kind of stuff I would read. I'd read a lot of stuff in here, and I meet guys that would do this. One of the stories is called "He Sold Himself Short," and they've got a lot of stories in here, in the big book, that are wonderful stories. They've got a lot of things that are wonderful in here, and you meet a lot of people that have similar stories, and they're similar to the kind of people that are put forth in the big book. I want to read this one story that I just like, because it's sort of, I mean, for me, I'm not saying, you know, we all like different kinds of music. For me, this sort of encapsulizes the kind of person I really wanted to be, and I didn't know how to get there. There was like a wall between me and this deal, and I would listen to stuff like this, and I would be amazed, because I would hear the words, and I think I understood the words, but I just didn't know how you could get there. I believed him. Just like I believe my sponsors, the second sponsor I was telling you about, Joe Snyder, that's why I talk about these guys, because I am absolutely convinced that a lot of what happened to me had to do with hanging around these men and doing what they told me to do and following their instructions. And following their instructions. That's a tough thing for alcoholics to do, to submit yourself to another person, especially when you feel crappy about yourself. Because when you feel crappy about yourself, you don't want people telling you what to do, because it just makes you feel like crappier. So you got to fight them. You know what I mean? It's a very difficult thing for an alcoholic to say yes and to do stuff, even stuff you don't want to do. And for some reason, I wanted what they had so much, you know, that I ended up doing what they told me to do. Maybe some with a little fight or not, and I hung out with these men. So if anybody gets anything from anything I say, I'd like them to somehow remember that whatever that guy had, it had something to do with hanging around people and who he hung around with. In any event, here's what it says. It says 295. So Joe Snyder, he was also a guy who, I think he graduated high school, and he was a mail carrier, and he died with 35 years of sobriety. He taught me a lot of good things, a lot of wonderful things. He was a wonderful, wonderful sponsor, and he also didn't appreciate me. It's very abusive. Didn't appreciate my brilliance, and used to straighten my ass out a lot. And now my sponsor, he died, and now my sponsor is John Glenn. He's got 55 years, and he's a Baptist preacher. And he straightens my ass out in other ways. So, you know, I always need to be hanging around with men who are straightening me out, you know, and they were sarcastic. In any event, 295. This is called "He Sold Himself Short." These last 18 years have been the happiest of my life, trite though that statement may seem. 15 of those years I would not have enjoyed had I continued drinking. I know how you feel. Doctors, believe me, doctors told me before I stopped that I had only 3 years at the outside to live. This latest part of my life has had a purpose. Well, actually, not much different than most people in AA rooms except crying. Listen, I don't want to. I'm not talking about you guys. I was talking to somebody that, you know, when you really start understanding this deal and getting comfortable in your own skin and stop worrying what other people think about you and what you're going to say and all that sort of stuff, you start realizing, and believe me, I'm not talking about this group. I don't want you to think that essentially most AA meetings are made up of people exactly like that, except they're big. Well, one day, some of you are going to stay sober for long periods of time, and you're going to remember what I said, and you're going to say, that son of a bitch was right. A lot of whining and crying and gnashing of teeth and thumb-sucking crybabies, you know? And, but hey, listen, I love it, you know, because it's sort of fun to watch, and I just love alcoholics. That's my deal. I am an alcoholic, so I know that deal. These last 18 years have been the happiest of my life. Trite though that statement may seem, 15 of those years I would not have enjoyed had I continued drinking. Doctors told me before I stopped that I had only 3 years at the outside to live. This latest part of my life has had a purpose, not in the great things accomplished, but in daily living. Courage to face each day has replaced the fears and uncertainties of earlier years. Acceptance of things as they are has replaced the old impatient, chomping at the bit to conquer the world. I have stopped tilting at windmills and instead have tried to accomplish the little daily tasks, unimportant in themselves, but tasks that are an integral part of living fully. Where derision, contempt, and pity were once shown me, I now enjoy the respect of many people. Where once I had casual acquaintances, all of whom were fair-weather friends, I now have a host of friends who accept me for what I am, and over my AA years, I have made many real, honest, sincere friendships that I shall always cherish. I'm rated as a modestly successful man. My stock of material goods isn't great, but I have a fortune in friendships, courage, self-assurance, and an honest appraisal of my own abilities. Above all, I have gained the greatest thing accorded to any man, the love and understanding of a gracious God who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust where I have been able to reap the rich rewards that come from showing a little love for others and from serving them as I can. And I don't know what it is. You know, I'm not a theologian or anything, but I just love that stuff. I'd like to be where that guy is. You know, if I could get what that guy had, and I realized that what AA is all about, what he's talking about, what he's putting words, what AA gives almost every old-timer that gets his act together that I've ever met, fits that sort of mold. And you know, in the eighth step, it says the whole purpose of the eighth step is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to other people. And the God of my understanding, it's just my theology, you know, because it does talk about God and it gives him certain attributes. He says he's all powerful. He'll give us everything. This is what it says. It says when we sincerely take the position of turning our lives over to God, he's the Father, we're the children. That's the triumphant arch we walk through. We quit playing God. When we sincerely took that position, being all powerful, he gives us everything we need. Everything we need if we stay close to him and perform his work well. Gives us everything we need. You know, I have three daughters and one son. And one of my daughters, and they're grown. You know, I got a 23-year-old, a 29-year-old. I don't even know, 23, 29, 30. I don't know. And they're old. Not old, but I mean young, but your age. In any event, they're adults. And but, you know, they're going through the deal. You know, they're going through what young people go through. You know, people the ages of 25 and 50 sort of go through. And you go through it also after, before that. They're going through the struggle. They got kids. You know, like two of them have kids. They got husbands. They got work. They got work problems. One of them just got let go. They got money problems. They bought a house. They can't afford, you know. They went through everything I went through in Alcoholics Anonymous, raising three or four kids. you know, going to the end of the month and not and having two cars and not enough money to put gas in the cars. They're going, you know, being behind in the mortgage. They're going through, especially these days, they're going through the battle of the money. Now, you know, some people, I guess, get to go through, I was a time in my life I went through a battle with cancer. And you go through battles in different areas of your life. But for the most part, in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I see is most people are going through battles with finances. You know, which is not a bad thing, because when I see people really going down the tubes, it's usually because they have too much money. You know, that's sort of like the governor God gives us, the thorn in our flesh gives us, to keep us from going totally insane. It's sort of like, and it's a rough deal. It's a rough deal when you don't have money. I don't know what it's like for a woman, but I know for a man, it's a terrible, it's a shameful thing. It's not shameful, but you feel ashamed when you're broke. You feel ashamed when you don't have money. You feel ashamed when you're behind in the bills or when your house is foreclosed. Or you feel like a failure. You don't want anybody to know. You don't want to talk about it really at meetings. You don't want to talk about it to anybody. You just sort of feel crappy inside. And you know, my daughter came by, one of my daughters came by to see me, and she had the baby with her, one of the babies with her, and she said, she came to my office, and she said, "Dad, would you do me a favor and watch the baby for a few minutes, because I need to run over to Publix and sort of like cash a check, or, you know, so I have money to put gas in the car, and I don't want to take the baby with me." And she started leaving. I said, "Well, hold on, sweetheart." I said, "You don't have to worry about that." And I took $40 out of my pocket. I said, "Just take this." And she said, no, forget about it. I don't want to take it." And I said, "Take the money." He says, "No, Dad, forget it. I'm not asking for money. I'll get my own money out. And I know they're going through rough times." I said, "Sweetheart," I said, "I want you to have the money." I said, "Take the money." I said, "I'm your father. I'm giving you the money." And I know what it's like to be ashamed to take money. You know? Now, I know there's probably a couple people out there saying, "I would have grabbed that sucker." You know what I mean? But I know what it's like. I know what it's like to want the money and need the money and be ashamed to ask for the money and ashamed to take the money. Because somehow deep down inside, you feel you don't deserve it. Or it makes you feel bad to take the money. But I want to tell you something. I love her so much. I wanted to give her the money because I'm her father. She has nothing to be ashamed of to take the money from me. I'm just grateful that I have the money to give her. I'm just grateful that I have the money to give her the money. She has no idea how good it makes me feel to be able to give her the money. And she took the money, and I hugged her, and I said, "I love you. You just have a wonderful day." And, you know, she left. You know, and this is just my deal. I sort of think that's the way the Father is with us. You know, I think a lot of alcoholics get a lot of really good crap happening to them in AA. I see a lot of people in AA that have an incredible life. Incredible stuff is happening to them, you know, and they're ashamed to grab onto it. They don't think it's real. I know for years I didn't think it was real. I was just waiting for the other shoe to drop. Because I knew, because you know why? Because I knew I didn't deserve it. I knew I didn't deserve the life I had. Because I knew I was a piece of shit. I knew I was a piece of crap. I knew I wasn't good. I knew I wasn't. Hey, listen, nobody knows me like I know me. I knew I wasn't good enough. And so even though good things were happening all around me, if you ask me how things go, and I'd say it's okay, because I just knew any second that sucker was going to be grabbed from me because I didn't deserve it. But you want to know something? God didn't give it to me because I deserved it. The God of my understanding doesn't give it to me because I deserve it, because I probably don't. He gave it to me because He loves me. And because He has the money and He wants me to have it. And let me tell you something. The God of my understanding, which is whatever name you put on, is God of your understanding. He loves you too, and He wants you to have it. You may think you don't deserve it, and you probably don't, but it doesn't matter because it's a gift. And He wants you to have it. Because if He didn't want you to have it, I got news for you. You wouldn't be in this room in the first place. Because you did nothing to deserve to be in this room while people are dying out there. And it's a very important, and guilt is a horrible thing. It separates us from other people. It separates us from God. And we don't even know we have it. I got divorced from my first wife. you know, about you know, a year or so after I can't even remember whether it was before I got sober or after. You know, it's all fuzzy now, but the bottom line is I got visitation rights. No, as a matter of fact, I was still drinking. And I was supposed to pick up my son on a Saturday morning, and I tell this story. And you know, this is just one story, but I mean, there's probably a thousand stories like this, similar to this. This is just one I remember. And I had been out Friday night doing what we do on Friday nights when we're drinking, and I had run into this gal named Sally, and you know, on Saturday morning I was supposed to pick up my son. I had been telling him for weeks I was going to take him to, my son was maybe about 7 years old. I had been telling him for weeks that I was going to take him to the zoo. You know, you're taking, yeah, I'm going to take you to the zoo. And I want to tell you something, like all alcoholics, yeah, you ever not do something, but you really intended to do it? Yeah, you ever, when somebody says, why didn't you do it, you say something like this, well, I intended to do it. And you actually think that means something? You know, why didn't you put the check in the mail? Well, I was going to do it, you know, and you think that's like an answer. You know what I mean? That should satisfy them, you know? Because for a nanosecond, I actually really sincerely wanted to do it. So, you know, the way I thought, I don't know about you, the way I thought is, as long as you sincerely wanted to put the check in the mail, that's sort of like the same thing as putting the check in the mail. You know, and that should sort of like cover the child support, that you wanted to do it, and you're being sincere about it. But in any event, so I had told my son I was going to take him to the zoo, and I really wanted to take him to the zoo, and I was really going to take him to the zoo. That kind of thinking is like really wanting to stop drinking, really intending to stop drinking. You know, that's what alcoholics are. That's the way we are. That's how crazy we are. Whether it has to do with drinking or putting the check in the mail or showing up on time or whatever it is, constantly making promises that we fully intend to keep and just not showing up. The world judging us by our actions and we judging us by our intentions. But somehow, in some way, in our sick, alcoholic, deluded mind, rationalizing, telling ourselves rational lies that makes us somehow believe that intending to do it and doing it is the same deal. And it's somehow, it's almost like drinking. It may not be true, but it sure makes me feel better. And God knows, if you know anything about me and anything about alcoholics, the most important thing on my mind is me. Yeah, I'm telling you, you know. And if there's anything that's important to me, is that I should not feel pain. I mean, if there's anything that's important to me, is that I should not feel bad for anything. That I should not feel guilty. You know what I mean? God forbid I should feel guilty or feel fear. I will do anything to run away from fear and guilt and pain. I will do anything to avoid that deal. I will hurt any person. I'll be as irresponsible as possible. I will prostitute every ideal I have so as not to feel pain and stand up for my responsibility and somehow put some sort of gloss on that so that it makes it sound like I'm a hero or something. Then I don't even know how that works. It's just the way alcoholics think. Sober or drunk, it don't matter. You know, I'd love to be able to say, I'd love to be able to tell you I did all this bad stuff because booze made me do it. I wish I could say booze made me do it. Let me tell you something. Most of the bad things I did to people, I did stone, cold, sober. And some of the bad crap I did and the bad mistakes I made, even after, I did the same things to some people, even after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, after I got sober. And the only thing booze did for me is allow me to live with my sorry self while I was doing it and tell myself these rational lies. And so at 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to pick up my son, and the phone rings, and it's Sally. And she says, hey, listen, Russell, myself and my son's waiting for me. My son and me and the girls are going out on the boat. Would you like to come with us? And so I'm thinking, there's my son who's waiting for me. I've been promising him for weeks that I'm going to pick him up. And there's Sally and the girls and the booze and the sex and the whatever the heck it is out there, you know. And I'm having this incredible debate. Sally and the girls, you know, Sally and the girls and the booze and the boat, or my son. I must have agonized over that for about 3 seconds. And it was anchors away. And I didn't even call up my son. Well, why call him up and even get into that stuff, you know? Because this is the way I think. He wouldn't have any fun with me. He'll have more fun with his mother. He'll have more fun with his mother. He wouldn't like hanging out with me. And I don't know what it is, but somehow an incredibly brilliant alcoholic like me with a high IQ can somehow rationalize the idea that I don't have to call him up. Well, you know why I didn't want to call him up? Because that would have been painful. That would have been embarrassing. You know, it's better if I just sort of like, you know, go out the back shack, you know what I mean? I'll just sneak out and not call. So he's sitting there waiting for me, and I'm like gone. And I'm on the boat, and what do you think I'm doing? I'm drinking. What a wonderful guy I am. But you know, deep down inside where I live, where that constitutionally, because I'm constitutionally capable of being honest with myself, you know, there's that little picture of Dorian Gray down there with that black mark is put in there, and you know what it's saying? It's saying, you are some sort of asshole. You are some sort of bum. Because you know who lives their lives that way, disappointing people, and not living up to their responsibilities? Bums live their lives that way. And I was a bum. I might have had a law degree. I might have had a bunch of postgraduate degrees. I might have wore a three-piece suit. I might have had all that deal going for me. Had a plaque on the wall, whatever it is. But I was a bum. And deep down inside, I knew I was a bum. And I knew who I was. You know, but you can drink and sort of make believe that that stuff isn't there. And so years down the road, even after I'm sober, and you can multiply that deal, that situation I just told you, why don't you just multiply it times 10,000 times to 500 people? Because that's the way I live my life. Doing whatever I want to do whenever I wanted to do it, if it pleased me, if it made me feel better. You know, why don't you just multiply it 1,000 times? So you know, and I'm sitting here and I don't understand why I'm sober 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, and I don't understand why don't I feel better? I don't understand. Well, I'm driving along and I haven't done anything wrong. I haven't hurt anybody. I'm trying to work this program to the best of my ability, and all of a sudden a voice comes in my head and says, you're an asshole. I don't understand why I'm driving along and thinking about killing myself. Thinking about suicide all the time. I don't understand why I don't think I deserve to have a good life. I don't understand when good things happen to me, I think, well, this isn't going to last. I don't understand why I'm so ashamed all the time. I don't understand why I have problems. I don't understand why, how come I don't feel better? How come people say, how you doing? Say, so. I don't understand what's going on because I can't even feel, all I know is I'm doing this thing and I'm doing it hard and I ain't feeling, and there's something wrong. Because you know something, that deal with the kid, where I left him, you know, and didn't go to the zoo, that happened 5 years ago. That happened 6 years ago. Some of this stuff happened 10 years ago. It's not even on the forefront of my mind, but it's there. Trust me, that mark doesn't go away. You know, that mark doesn't go away. When I see that guy, I talked about this the other day, when I see that guy on the other side of the street that I screwed out of the money, you know what I mean? And I go, man, I hope he doesn't see me. And I walk in the opposite direction. Or if I don't go to that party or that event because so-and-so might be there, when my life is, in my life and where I go and what I do is dictated by who might show up, I'm not going to go there because what if she shows up? I'm not going to go to that room because what if he shows up? I'm not going to go there. When I start turning around and walking the other day and ducking around the corner because I don't want to meet that guy, I don't want to see that guy, when I'm all of a sudden avoiding returning phone calls, ripping up envelopes and mail and stuff like that, when I'm doing that stuff, and even when I get away with it, even when I duck out the back and he doesn't see me, and I walk away and I go, whew, man, that was close. And maybe an hour goes by, 2 hours go by, 4 hours go by, a day goes by, 3 days go by, and I forgot about it. You think that thing's gone away? It's still sitting back there. You know how I know it's sitting back there? Because if he shows up again, I'm ducking again. That deal, that fear, that guilt, that shame came from somewhere, and it didn't just fly away just because I avoided him. And it still shows up in my life. It doesn't look like him. It looks like you're an asshole. It looks like you're a jerk. It looks like you're not ready to speak. It looks like they're never going to like you. It looks like, you know, it looks like I'm not good enough. I mean, you could stay sober for a gazillion years. It looks like it's like fear. It's a horrible way to live. You know, and I gotta somehow get past that deal, and that's what this eighth and ninth step is about. That's what these deals are about. This is, you know, I love, but in order, here's the crazy thing. It's not crazy, it's just, hey, it's biblical. You know, I love the story of the prodigal son. I don't know how many people know the story of the prodigal son. I just have it on my heart just to sort of tell you that story, because it's such a template for me for what this deal is about. For what this deal is about, especially with the father. And the way the prodigal son story goes, and I think it's in Matthew. I don't know if it's Matthew or Luke. Probably Luke. And the book of Luke is the story. And it's actually a story about our lives. It's a story about you guys. It's a story about you guys. Written thousands of years ago. It's about this father. And he has two sons. And one of the sons is a whack job. Even back then they had whack jobs. You know? Really, you ought to read some of this stuff. And he says to his father, he says, give me my money, I'm out of here. He says, give me my money, I'm out of here. And give me my inheritance, I'm out of here. And the father gives him his inheritance, and he splits. And the father doesn't chase after him, he lets him go. And the way the story goes is the kid then, you ready for this? Wait, this is right out of the Bible. He says he goes to a foreign land and wastes his money on prostitutes and booze, basically. And he winds up in a pigsty working for another person feeding pigs, which is not a good thing for a Jewish kid. Trust me on this. Bad. It's about as low, it's what we would call hitting bottom. And while he's sitting there, and he says he didn't have enough money, so he ate the same pig slop the pigs were eating. And at one point in time, this is what happens. He says to himself, he says, I once lived in a house with a father who loved me. And he says, I'm sitting here eating pig slop. He says, I'm gonna go back to my father's house. He remembers he has a father. And he says, I'm gonna tell my father, he says, I've sinned against you. I've wronged you. And I don't deserve to be your son. He says, but I would appreciate if you would just let me be a hired worker and work for you. And the way the story goes is before he's halfway there, his father sees him, who's been looking for him, and he runs out, and he puts a cloak on him, and they have a party, and he hugs him, and he says, and he gives him the $40. Well, it doesn't say that. I made that up, okay? But something like that. But here's the deal. What I understand now about the eighth step, from a biblical and from a process sort of view, is that in order to really understand and get forgiveness and to make the amends, I must appreciate the harm and the hurt and the wrong I did and where I've gone to. It's not enough to be like what I used to be. It's not enough for me to rip, rape, run, and hurt, and then say a simple, I'm sorry, I won't do it again, I apologize, it was a mistake, I intended to do it, pay the money late, and then make believe there's no problem, just to do it again. I've got to somehow, just like with the drinking, you know what it says with the drinking? We have to somehow accept to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. It says in the book, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences and his devastating weakness, his sobriety will be precarious. Of true happiness, he'll find none at all. Unless and until an alcoholic, unfortunately for us, which is very difficult for us, unless and until an alcoholic actually accepts how low he has sunk to, how many people he has hurt, the harm he has done, he will never be able to do a proper amends, because he'll never really be able to know what he's making amends for. He'll never even appreciate what he's making amends for. He'll be doing the same old stuff, just say a simple I'm sorry, get out of there, Jack, so they don't hurt you anymore, and walk out the back and say, I'm glad that's over with. Somehow, some way, I've got to realize in my innermost self what it meant to leave that 7-year-old kid waiting for me at the door. What it meant to leave my first wife when she was a good wife and she was a decent person. She never did anything wrong, but I just wanted to screw around. She did absolutely nothing wrong, but I just wanted to go ahead and screw around. You understand what I'm saying? So it was okay for me to dump her and go to somebody else because I was just bored. I had to recognize what kind of person and who I was and what I sunk to and what that was, or else if I didn't recognize that and feel that pain and understand that sorrow, you know something? I'm an alcoholic. I'll do it again like that. Don't kid yourself. I'll do it again like that. The first sign of you not treating me the way you should treat me, or my life not going the way my life is going, or you're not being the wife I think you should be, I'm like, hey, I'm out of here. My way, I don't need this crap. I won't stay because I'm not a stayer. I'm self-centered. You know, and that has to do, understanding that stuff has to do with having 30-year marriages. Has to do with understanding what it means to say, till death do us part, and then 5 years later, because things are rough, say, I'm out of here. Understanding a little bit about an oath and giving your word and sticking with people in rough times. And being a man and being a grown-up instead of a 2-year-old child. In a bar drinking and telling what a bitch your wife is. You know, it has to do with serious stuff. You understand what I'm saying? Understanding how bad you... Unfortunately, it's not enough to say I'm sorry. Somehow, some way, I've got to understand the sin, the problem, the defect, the wrong, the harm I've done. Which is probably why we want us to write it down, because I don't know about your mind, but my mind is like one of these, you ever see one of these things these kids have where you write on it and then you go like this and it disappears? You know what I'm talking? This is the way my mind works. The worst possible thing, I can do the worst possible thing to you, and all of a sudden another thought comes around and whoop, it disappears. I can sort of, it's almost like there's a little part of my brain that manufactures some sort of drug or something, where no matter how guilty and bad I feel, a thought will come about it. It'll be like, he deserved it, or he shouldn't have done that, or she shouldn't have done that, or she's full of shit, or it wasn't my fault. There's some I can manufacture a thought in a nanosecond to make the pain and the guilt go away. Sort of, I think it makes it go away, and somehow I'm not at fault, and I'm not, and I can rip it. But you know, when you write it down on paper, when you put it right out there, and you write it down. And then you got to take it to some sponsor and listen to his crap. You know? I mean, God forbid, imagine if you had to take it to somebody like me. You know? You know, I do believe, I absolutely believe that, and this is just part of my theology and about the way I think God works, is I think the whole, they say the reason, the way I understand it is one of the things that tells you whether you understand that relationship with God is how much you love other people. Has to do with loving the brothers. You know, but I'm going to tell you something about love. Love's a funny thing. At least in my theology, and I could be wrong about this. It's just the way I feel. Sometimes love doesn't look like love. It looks like a spanking. It looks like being rebuked. You know, sometimes the guy that you hate the most, that loves you the most, is the guy that spanks you the hardest. That looks you in the eye and tells you stuff that you don't want to hear. And sometimes the guy that's patting you on the back is your worst enemy. Sometimes the guy in the bar was buying you the drink and saying, yeah, that wife is a bitch. Yeah, those people in the job are assholes. Yeah, you're right and they're wrong. Sometimes that guy is the guy you got to run away from. And sometimes the guy that's your friend is the guy that's looking in your eye and says, why don't you grow the hell up? Why don't you go out and drink because you're polluting the air around here? Why don't you grow? You're 45 years old, you're 55 years old. Why don't you look in the mirror and grow up? Sometimes that's the guy who really loves you. You know why? Because he's less concerned with what you think about him and more concerned with turning your ass around. And so that's the kind of truth. Because isn't this a program of honesty? The only requirement, isn't this a program? You think honesty feels good all the time? I mean, I have a plaque in my office that says the truth. You remember from the Good Few Good Men's? The truth, you can't handle the truth. You know, the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off. You know, I mean, people don't like the truth. They don't like hearing the truth. And that's what that's what all these steps are about. It's about getting truthful with yourself and other people as to what the wrongs really are. And you know something? Here's the cool thing. Once you appreciate the wrong, once you see the wrong, once you see the damage, then you want to know something? The desire to fix it and make amends becomes strong. And not only that, it becomes clearer what you may have to do in order to make the amends. You know, cause I don't know about you, but you almost don't have to make amends to me at all as long as you come up to me and say, you know something, I was wrong. And at least you know what you did. You know, I hate people say, I'm sorry, but they don't even know what they're sorry for. They're just saying it like alcoholics say it just so they can get some peace of mind and you'll forgive them and then they can walk away. But somehow, when somebody says to me, you know, when I did this to you, when I did that to you, I just want you to know I was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. Hey, that's almost like an amends right there. Validating me and saying he was wrong. And that proves to me that a person is sincere. And that's what this eighth step is all about. It takes a lot of guts to do this stuff. To sit down and face yourself and put it in front of other people. And I don't think it's something that we do naturally. I don't know too many alcoholics that sit down before they come in here and make a list of all the people they had harmed. You know what I mean? And get willing to make amends to them all. I don't know too many people do that. So this is absolutely only something we do in here after we come in here in order to get right with God and have a relationship with Him. So thank you very much. I'm sorry. Give me a second.